Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this half hour is Carol Anderson. She's the author of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. It's a book that has gained many accolades. Among them, it was named a National Book Critics Circle Award winner in 2016. Also a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. The Washington Post recognized it as well. The Boston Globe. Many honors for this important book. Carol Anderson is the Charles Howard Candler Professor, also Chair of African American Studies at Emory University in Atlanta. Her research focuses on public policy regarding race, justice, and equality. Carol Anderson, welcome to our program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Ben.
I want to mention that you'll be speaking on Saturday, January 20th at the UNI campus in Cedar Falls at 7 p.m. Let's start with the title of your book, White Rage. It's a title that can lead people to think that it's about perhaps the Klan or about Nazis. That's not what it's about. Tell us, what is it about?
Absolutely. It definitely is not about the Klan. It is about the way that public policy responds to African American advancement very coolly, very methodically, very systematically, and in ways that not only undermine African Americans' access to their basic rights, but has a horrific effect on the quality of life in the United States as well. This white rage comes out of the Congress. It comes out of state legislatures, school boards. It comes out of the White House. For instance, after the Brown decision in 1954 that ended Jim Crow, and that said separate but equal, you know, separate but equal has no place in the United States, the response, you know, so we often think of how, you know, you see the lynchings that happened afterwards. Mm-hmm. But when you think about it, you also had massive resistance, where you had over 100 members of Congress sign a manifesto vowing to use every legal lever at their command to undermine the Supreme Court decision. And they did.
And what year? What year was this?
School boards and legislators that shut down entire public school systems. In Prince Edward County, for instance, they shut the school down for 5 years. Now, what they did was to also provide funding, though, using taxpayer dollars, so that white children could go to all-white private academies and continue their education. That's white rage.
Okay, and that, what you're detailing there, is in the 1950s.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's come up to the present time. I want to go back in history because I know this book looks at the roots of racism in this country going way back to the period of emancipation, the anti-emancipation revolts, also Reconstruction. But let's come up to the present here since we're very close to it in the 1950s. What did white rage have to do with this most recent election in 2016?
It had everything to do with it. When you think about the election of Barack Obama to the presidency, a black man in the White House, that is like the penultimate advancement. And the response was intense. One of the first responses was a wave of voter suppression laws, because what Obama had done was, through incredible organizing, was to bring 15 million new voters into the electorate. Now, generally, what we say is we want a democracy that is vibrant, that is vital, that brings people in, where people have a stake in this nation. This should be something we're embracing. But instead, the response was to look at who he brought in and to figure out how to craft laws, how to ensure that these people did not vote.
Mm-hmm.
So you had 2 million new African Americans coming to the polls, 2 million new Latinos coming to the polls, 600,000 Asian Americans who hadn't voted before coming to the polls. You had almost a doubling in the increase in the numbers of the poor, people who made less than $15,000 a year, coming to the polls. When you think about the voter suppression laws that are on the books, what they have targeted are African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, and the poor.
Okay, let me stop you right there, because what you're calling voter suppression laws, many in our audience will call, laws that, at least the people who enact these are not calling them voter suppression, of course. They are saying these are laws we need to protect the integrity of our voting process and prevent voter fraud. You're saying this is just a cloak. This is not the case?
Oh, it is so not the case. For instance, down in Florida, one of the chief Republicans, and I can't remember his name right now, but he said, look, voter fraud is a marketing ploy. It is the language that we use in order to get these bills through. Justin Levitt, who is a law professor in California, he did a study and looked at voter fraud, particularly the kind of fraud that requires a voter ID. So that's impersonation. And he found 31 cases from 2000 to 2014 out of 1 billion votes. Mm. 31 out of 1 billion. What these laws say they need to do is somehow stop this rampant voter fraud. In Texas, there were 2 cases. And Texas has one of the most draconian voter suppression laws on the books. When you look at North Carolina, the Fourth Circuit said that North Carolina's legislature targeted African Americans with nearly surgical precision. Because, again, it sounds – part of the way that white rage works is it sounds commonsensical. I've had folks say to me, look, you've got to have an ID to be able to take out a book from the library. How hard is it to get an ID?
Right.
We've got to protect our – you know. So I hear those arguments. What we don't see is how they have defined what is an acceptable ID.
Well. Also, but I mean, Iowa has a new voter ID law. Let's take that as an example. If you don't have a voter ID, like a driver's license, you will simply have to vote provisionally, meaning that you can vote and it will be confirmed. So why isn't that a level playing field for all? It doesn't matter what skin color you have. What's the matter with that if your vote does count, but they just want to confirm that you're actually voting legally?
Right. And so one of the things is to look at provisional ballots. What has happened in state after state after state is that overwhelmingly provisional ballots are not counted. Provisional ballots often require another level, that you come back within a week, or that you come back within 4 days with some other documentation. The 2016 election was the first election without the protection of the Voting Rights Act. And so states that had been under the Voting Rights Act to ensure that they did not discriminate against American citizens simply because of their race or because of their language.
What difference do you think that first election not under the Voting Rights Act since the 1960s, what difference did that make in the outcome?
A massive difference. The black voter turnout rate declined by 7%.
Mm-hmm.
When you begin to think about a state like Wisconsin, where Trump won by only 27,000 votes, and Milwaukee, which is where 70% of African Americans live in Wisconsin, had massive voter suppression by Scott Walker targeted at them. And so the turnout rate in Milwaukee was down by thousands upon thousands of votes. It matters. It's doing what is designed to do. But under the cloak, and this is the power of white rage, is that you don't see a cross burning to stop people from voting. Instead, you see these laws that look legitimate, but they're not.
If you've just joined us, Carol Anderson is my guest this half hour. Her book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide, goes back in our history many decades, centuries back, to trace sort of overt racism in the form of the Klan or neo-Nazis, but in what she's been talking about, sort of institutional. Would that be a term for
yes.
it, Carol, institutional
yes.
racism?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the 2016 election. Let me play a clip of then-candidate Donald Trump. I'm sure you'll be aware of this clip once I play it, speaking in 2015 with CNN's Don Lemon and being asked by Don Lemon, are you a racist?
Are you racist?
I am the least racist person that you have ever met. I am the least racist person.
Are you bigoted in any way?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
Islamophobic?
I'm a person, no, not at all. I'm a person who happens to be very smart, and I happen to have a certain street sense, and I know where things are going.
Okay, President Trump has been in office for a year. Do you think our president is a racist?
Yes.
Why?
Absolutely, positively. And so let me move even further on that. Remember that Trump was fined by Richard Nixon's Department of Justice for refusing to rent to African Americans. That Trump took out a full-page ad arguing for the death penalty for the Central Park Five, who were four African-American and one Latino who had been accused of a gang rape in Central Park. It turned out, A, that they didn't do it, and B, that the death penalty that he was arguing for had already been found unconstitutional by the Supreme Court because African-American men were overwhelmingly, sometimes the only ones who were executed in the United States for rape.
What about since he's been president? In the year that he's been president, what can you point to specifically as things you would call racist actions or words?
How about leaving Puerto Rico abandoned and saying the problem is that these people want everybody to do everything for them. They have just been hit with a hurricane that has devastated them. They are without power. We're now going in past 3 months of this. Mm-hmm. That's racist. Mm-hmm. When you have his Department of Justice go into Texas, that the courts have found repeatedly that their voter suppression laws have been have a discriminatory impact and a discriminatory intent. And Jeff Sessions goes in on the next round and says, no, these laws are just fine. They are legal. So you get the Department of Justice weighing in on this. How about the mass deportations? Or how about ending the DACA program, the Dreamers program? Or how about now trying to hold the Dreamers hostage for an $18 billion wall to somehow stop immigration coming in from Mexico?
Others would see that as securing our borders, right?
And it's really interesting right now as they're working to deport 200,000 El Salvadorans that those who are targeted for deportation are people of color.
If they were, say, of white European ancestry, the 200,000 would not be going back.
No, this is targeted. When he said, make America great again, it was a call to create, to try to recreate America of at least the 1950s and hopefully the 1920s.
Carol Anderson is my guest. White Rage, her book, came out in 2016. Much acclaim about the book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Let's go back in history in the few minutes we have remaining, Carol Anderson. Tell us, how is what you're describing as institutional racism here in your book rooted in our history? Take us back perhaps to the 1800s.
I start off in the Civil War and in looking at Reconstruction, for instance. And one of the things that becomes very clear is how the 13th Amendment, which ended slavery, the 14th Amendment, which provides for citizenship, saying if you were born here, you are a citizen, and you are due equal protection under the law, and the 15th Amendment, which deals with the right to vote, how those were systematically undermined by the U.S. Supreme Court in a series of decisions that are absolutely mind-boggling. How you have Andrew Johnson, who was the president after Abraham Lincoln, how he worked overtime to rebuild the South with the Confederates, who had attacked the United States, and in doing so, to deny African Americans their basic rights. I walk this through his veto of the 1866 Civil Rights Act, where he says, if blacks get their rights, it can only be at the expense of whites. Mm-hmm. Rights don't work that way.
Right.
But one of the things that, to me, helps fuel white rage, that keeps it sustained, is the kind of narrative that sees America as a zero-sum game. When you pit people against each other like that, this is what fuels the policies.
In your look at historical racism in this country, has our definition, also very recently, it seems everybody's being called a racist, and a lot of things are being called racism. It seems like a broad spectrum. Is that being defined differently by different people, and is it watering down what that means to something that is less meaningful?
You know, I don't think so. I think what is happening is that we're beginning to understand in ways that we hadn't before that racism is not just the folks you saw marching with tiki torches in Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm.
We have, as a nation, found a level of comfort in trying to narrowly define racism in terms of this kind of overt, violent, malicious, skinhead, cross-burning way. That's racism. Therefore, everything else that we do is not racist. But when you begin to think about, for instance, the way that the federal government would use redlining via FHA loans to ensure that blacks had no access to quality housing or to home ownership. That's racist.
Mm-hmm. We have just a few minutes left. What will it take to remedy the problems you see, these problems rooted in decades, centuries of American history?
You know, I think it's going to take, one, us having a real conversation about race and racism in the United States. Not any of the polemics, not any of this hurling accusations.
What does that mean, a real conversation about race? How do you identify that?
And I identify that by one where we're operating from a common set of facts and evidence. Because part of the problem is we don't even have the same evidentiary basis to have the conversation in the United States. I heard a white man say, you know, the problem is that whites built this nation, and now you got all of these blacks and these immigrants coming in over here trying to take it away from us. You can't start a conversation there.
Mm-hmm.
Because because you don't even have the same evidence base. It ignores slavery. It ignores the role of the Chinese in building the railroads. It ignores the work of so many other people. And this is not, again, to say that whites are not part of this nation. It's not that at all. It is to say that when we have a conversation based on evidence, on what the history really is, then we can begin to work our way out of this mess.
Carol Anderson, before we go, I have to ask you this question because we're speaking just a few days, just after a widely acclaimed speech by Oprah Winfrey at the Golden Globes. Your thoughts on Oprah as a possible candidate in 2020?
No.
No?
The speech was wonderful. What we have to be careful of is realizing that there is a skill set that a president must have, a policy understanding, an ability to work through and with Congress. You don't expect somebody to fly your plane who's never been a pilot. You don't expect somebody who has never gone to med school to somehow do open heart surgery on you. But somehow we have, and I know how this somehow happened, but we tend to think that, anybody can do that. And this is how we ended up with Donald Trump.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, Carol Anderson, the Charles Howard Candler Professor, Chair of African-American Studies at Emory University, speaking to us from Atlanta. And Carol Anderson will be speaking on Saturday, January 20th at the campus of University of Northern Iowa in the evening. Carol Anderson, thank you very much for joining us on River to River.
Oh, thank you so much, Ben.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Of course, we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.